So this story I've told so many times before that I was, that was the People's Park riot in Berkeley. National Guard occupied the city. Finally came to a confrontation on Telegraph Avenue. And the National Guard and the police were marching down, sort of clearing the street. And at a certain point, as they got near the main body of protesters, at a certain point I knew they were going to do tear gas. I'd been in these things before. So I just stepped down a side street. And as I stepped down the street, tear gas canisters went flying, and people started screaming and everything. So, and I ran to this devotee. It was actually McConwell, who was a very nice and ethereal devotee. And this was 1969. I think 68 or 69. Yeah, it must have been 69, like the spring of 69. And so he was leading a little kirtan party. And he was the only devotee, and the rest of the people were just, to show you what it was like back then in the Bay Area, Berkeley, San Francisco, 69, he must have had like about six or eight people with him, like boys and girls, and I don't think any two of them were dressed from the same century. I mean, people were just, it was the Bay Area, you know, San Francisco, Berkeley in 69, I mean, everyone was just dressed in different periods and centuries, Elizabethan, you know, Native American, or just like, and no two people from the same century or from the same culture. It's so theatrical. And they were all walking down the street, usually in the kirtan. I don't think any two people were doing the same melody. And everyone were even singing the same mantra. It was just like they were all somehow marching along. He might have been the only one that knew where he was.
How did you know he was a devotee?
He was dressed in a dhoti. And he had his little cartel. There were no regular Indian cartels. They would just buy these things like import stores, these little tiny cartels. Because they didn't have the regular ones. And so he was just walking down the street, and he didn't notice it. He was McConnell. He was just lost in his own kirtan. And then we just... Yeah, so I followed. I just joined in. I don't know what I was singing, but... I hope Hare Krishna. But anyway, so then I just followed them. And then we went from Telegraph all the way down to Shattuck, which is about five or six blocks down. And,
away from the Tiergast.
Yeah, away from the Tiergast. Yeah, it's like you say, this is north and south. So here's Telegraph. And we took a side street and then went west to Shattuck here, which is sort of like a, this, you know, commercial street, maybe like six blocks to the west. And then they went into some little cafe or something, you know. When you sat down with them to really order something, I guess you were.
Really?
Yes. It was 69, I mean, it was... It's just like in the commercial, you just sold your last pick. You might have ordered herbal tea or something. Yeah, it was just, I remember they were going to open a center in Berkeley. There was no center in Berkeley. They just had one in San Francisco, right in the middle of Haight Ashbury at a temple. That's when the Prabhupada, the famous one, the Prabhupada, you know, went to on Frederick Street. And so... They asked me, they invited me, they had a plan. It's you know, it's not too different what they were doing in Gainesville. The idea, is this Prabhupada given this idea? And the idea was that I could, instead of renting a place, I could rent a room from them. I could, remember, they would rent it, they were going to get to rent a house, and then I could rent a room there as a student. And I said, well, what do I have to do? And they said, oh, nothing, just have a little program in the morning. And that's 69. So, and then I said, well, yeah, maybe I'll do that. Well, it's funny, because what I thought was, in my mind, I was thinking, I really like the devotees, but their kirtans are a little too, like, boisterous and loud. And I was thinking, looking for a little more peaceful meditation. But I really like the devotees a lot, so In fact, they had a, what they called the free university there, where people could give different courses and even get some credit for it, you know, offer all to, because that was a big thing back then. It was a huge thing. And so devotees asked me to sign up for their, you know, bhakti yoga course. But I didn't. I signed up for a contemporary poetry class. But and I remember I was going to my contemporary poetry class that I'd signed up for, and I walked by the room where the devotee program was, and it's like, it was this rock of sock and gyrta, you know? It was like, you know, they were, you know, the cartoon of the walls went, you know, they were literally blowing the roof off the place. And I remember I walked by, and I think a devotee saw me walking by and said, "Hey, why don't you come and take art class?" And I just thought, it's too loud. It's funny, isn't it? But anyway, so then, so I said, well, maybe I'll, then they asked me to rent a room. I said, by the time you get back, you're coming back, you know, next semester, yes, in the fall, so why don't you rent a room from us? And so, so you know, that was 1969, I was like, I guess, how old was I? It's 20. No, still 20, because it was in the fall or the spring. And, you know, it was 96, so I basically gave them all my money. I think I had literally like maybe like $60 in my name. I think I gave them 40. They asked me, you know, was I to give like a down payment or like, you know, give an advance on that. And so I actually didn't expect to live with them, but I thought I'll just give them money anyway. So there was some little place, there was some lady who was sort of like into yoga, and so they were using her apartment. So I went there to give them the money, and when I got there, they were reading the Bible. I had a Bible class. That's how it is.
Why did you like the devotees?
It was just, I guess because I was one. It was just spontaneous. I just really loved the devotees, and you know, I liked the kids on the street I liked. And I remember McCullough's brother, Narayan Ryan, they would come out and give out toward the end of the spring, just before students went home for summer vacation. They were giving out prasadam, and they bring out this big fruit salad, and it was like Narayan Ryan, anyway. So he would like, they have this big, like a barrel, I guess, you know, of fruit. This huge bucket, and he would just like put both hands in. He would just bring it up, he's dripping, you know, yogurt and sugar, and just like put it in people's hands. And he would say, take more, take. I remember one time they're having a kirtan in front of the campus, and someone came to McConwell and said, don't people eat a lot of sugar? And it was like a macrobiotic thing. And I was listening because I was a student. And I was like, "What are they going to say?" You know the story? Mm-hmm. So he said, "I mean, he was like, well, you know, McConnell. So wonderful devotee. So he sort of closed his eyes, you know, and he was like that. And he would say, no. And someone said, yeah, no. He said, someone said, don't. Now first, yeah, they said you eat a lot of sugar. He said, yes, actually." Many of us will get diabetes, but we are not this body.
Oh.
What? And I was just listening, trying to understand, like, what's the Hare Krishna movement? And then someone said, well, what happens when you chant? Like, I mean, that was 1969. It was, like, totally the psychedelic era. It's like, what do you see? Like what happens when you chant? And so right across the street there from the main part of the entrance to campus, there was, like, an old, like, cigar store. They call it cigar store. You know, it was like a little drugstore, it's an old story, you know, from the way back when. So he said, when I chant Hare Krishna, there is cigar store, but I do not see cigar store. No, we do not see cigar store. I was trying to like figure out what the philosophy was. You've heard these stories. I've told you all these stories.
No, not that one.
Well, I told you, I mean, I've told it so many times, but the first time I still remember the first time I saw the devotees. I walked out of the class and they were sitting there. And I mean, Berkeley back in those days, it must have been 68, and Berkeley back in those days, like, there were like troubadours, like hippies and just wandering minstrels. Like, every day when you walked through campus, there would be people, like, from all over the world, like, singing or dancing or advocating something. It was just like, it was like a Renaissance carnival or something. In fact, I always tell the story, there was one guy that came through for a while, because Berkeley was like a must stop, you know, I mean, because there were just thousands, or not hundreds of thousands of young people just traveling around, hitchhiking, and, you know, Berkeley was an absolute must see. Everyone had to come to Berkeley. And so, there was one guy who was like a sort of a Bob Dylan wannabe. There were a lot of Bob Dylan wannabes back then. And so he was traveling through and he had a little microphone holder, I mean a harmonica. A harmonica holder on his neck and a guitar. And he would just sort of sit on they have these little trees, you know, on the entrance plaza in Berkeley. So he would just sit with his back against a tree and sing Mr. Tambourine Man. Hey, Mr. Tambourine, you know, like Bob Dylan.
Yeah.
And that was Sankarshan, so the guru in our Nesma. So anyway, so one day, I was just like watching him saying, "Mr." And that's what they used to call him, Tambourine Man, you know, and so he called himself the Tambourine Man, you know, he'd throw money into his guitar case. He's in this kind of guru now, but So the first time I saw the boys, I was coming out of a class one day, this was actually a very nice presentation. They came from the San Francisco Temple. They put down like a, you know, a Persian rug or Indian rug, and they actually had a tambura and a harmonium. And they were all sitting there, and it was really very beautiful. I mean, it was really a nice like bhajan. And there was a group of people around. That's what you do. You'd come out of class every day, and there'd be like groups of people. You'd go to see like what is it this time? Just everything imaginable. People preaching every imaginable religion. It's people from anywhere, everywhere, doing anything. And so I watched them chanting, and I was really attracted. And I realized, because I thought I was like, I mean, we really thought we were on the cutting edge of history. We thought we were the greatest thing. We thought we were just the culmination of all previous human history. In fact, there's no doubt about it. It was like, duh. We were young. We were in California. We were in Berkeley. And so when I saw the devotees, one of the first things I thought was that I felt like I was a hypocrite. Because I saw their shaved heads, and I realized that for all my pretension of being in higher consciousness, whatever, I'm actually attached to my hair. And I realized, I didn't feel bad about it. It was like an honest miss. Yeah, I could see I'm a hypocrite, and they're actually doing the real thing. So then I got a mantra card. I told you this story. Yeah, the first time I got my first mantra card, I was on my way to class one morning, and a devotee just handed me a mantra card. It would say, you know, chant these words and your life will be sublime or something. And I remember I looked down and read it, Hare Krishna. It's the first time I ever like really read it. And as soon as I said the word Krishna, I actually felt spiritual ecstasy. I mean, just as soon as I just saw the word Krishna, I had an ecstatic Krishna conscious experience of reading the word Krishna. You know, I just kept walking in the light change. I just kept walking. And seriously, you don't know what the effect is, isn't it? I someone handed me a card and I kept walking. Then I read it, I actually felt ecstasy. And then I would see devotees around, didn't take their free university class. And then Prabhupada came. I told you that story. Mm-hmm. Prabhupada came, and that really changed my life. That changed my life when I saw Prabhupada. After that, I would just be, I won't go into all the details, literally in the oddest situations. I remember one time, I would suddenly start chanting Hare Krishna. I remember one time I was, you know, the students are when they're away from home, away from their families, you know, you go to bed very, very, basically you go to bed and you should be getting up. So, anyway, I was walking home when I should have been getting up, and I was just sort of walking through, it was like, really, that must have been like 3 o'clock in the morning, 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. The city was just like totally dead, you know, it was quiet, and I was just walking through the city back to my place through Berkeley. And I just suddenly started ecstatically chanting Hare Krishna. It just felt spiritual ecstasy. I was just crying out the names of Krishna. That's after I saw Prabhupada. I mean, it really was like those stories in the CC where like Lord Chaitanya would just touch someone, they just started chanting, you know, crying out Krishna's name. It was really like that. After I saw Prabhupada, I would just become ecstatic. Just here or there, just become ecstatic. Start chanting Hare Krishna. It's really like one of those stories. And then, I've told you stories so many times, it was such reruns. Really. Then I had a really ecstatic experience. It was, it was Berkeley, 69. It was just a different world. It's like the young people had taken over the world. That's what it was like. And, so just like about a few days before I was going back to L.A. for the summer, Beverly Hills, this huge flatbed pickup truck, I told you this story, there's a huge flatbed pickup truck was just weaving its way through Berkeley, picking students up, or young people, because up in the Berkeley, the city of Berkeley sort of basically goes like, it's like on the west side of Berkeley is the San Francisco Bay. On the east side of Berkeley is the Berkeley Hills, it's high hills, and it's just sort of between the bay and these hills. And up on top of the hills, there's this park called, I forgot it. But it's famous, it's like, and there's this beautiful, now Tilden Park. And it's like, it's a beautiful, beautiful park. To have walking trails, you can see the San Francisco Bay and its forest, beautiful. It's just really a beautiful park. And there's a big meadow. And so in that meadow, they'd set up, it's like this free rock and roll concert. So this truck was going picking people up and taking them up into the hills, you know, for this big meadow, hilltop meadow for the concert, rock and roll concert. Mm-hmm. No, I exited these well-known bands, and so, I jumped on the truck. So then we went up to the, you know, everyone was getting on the truck. You know, everyone's got on the truck.
Yeah.
So we went up into the meadow, and they were setting up these huge speakers. I mean, you know, they had all, it was like a super 1969. Like those, just like the pictures you see in the documentaries, you know, everyone dressed the way they used to dress back then, you know, holding hands, dancing in circles and everything.
Is it right after Woodstock or right before Woodstock?
I don't remember. It was that time.
That summer.
Yeah. It was a summer of love or something. So.
Yeah.
So they're setting these huge speakers, and you know, just tuning, you can just blasting across the meadow. And so then, typical thing, McConwell got permission to go and chant before the concert started. That's what the Joys always do. They always go to these like be-ins and love-ins and rock and roll concerts and get permission to chant before the... And so we had these little cartels. They weren't even regular cartels, little junky cartels. You know, you get like a little import store. And so he was just, you know, Hare Krishna. I mean, it was just... All these sophisticated bands, these huge speakers are setting up, and he was just kind of like, they were kind of, these two devotees kind of like wailing. And I was watching that. And I was thinking, God, they got guts. Because they obviously weren't musicians or singers or anything, and they were, And I respected them. In those days, no one knew what the Hare Krishna movement was. There was no such thing as a Hare Krishna in an airport. There was no real Sankirtan. There was no book distribution. So we, back in those days, the devotees, they were just like totally part of the scene. And there was absolutely no negativity whatsoever. You know, devotees had never gone to an airport, never did anything. I mean, the movement wasn't aggressive. It was like this real peace-love movement. And so when McCunlow, when he finished the kirtan, and he was wearing his robes, and he was like a real avatu. And so as he was walking across the meadow, he had this whole group following him. He was like this, a guruji or something. Because that's what people saw the devotees back then. Mm-hmm. And I was in a different consciousness. And so I went up to him and I said to him, isn't everything beautiful? Because I was 20 years old, I was like totally into it. You know, it's this beautiful meadow, rock and roll concert, peace and love, higher consciousness. I just went up and said, isn't this everything beautiful? Uh-oh. And then he said to me, you know the story.
No.
He said to me, yes. So just think how beautiful is the source of all this. Oh. I finally got like a philosophical statement. And when I heard those words, I was actually stunned. I remember he just walked on, and he probably just thought, you know, he just said it and walked on. But I remember it was just completely the source of everything. Because no one talked like that. There was no philosophy, there was no, you know, just no one ever talked like that. And I was just stunned. I just stood there for like about 5 minutes just thinking about what he said. And then I remember the last night, he was 69, it must have been like early June 1969. And it was the last night before I was leaving the next morning to go back to LA for summer vacation. And I met this nice guy. He was from the University of Virginia. I still remember. In fact, he was a graduate student. He's coming to study at Berkeley, and he was a young guy with his wife. They were real nice, and you know, they were from Virginia. They just arrived in Berkeley, and somehow we met. So I was kind of showing him around. You know, we sort of hit it off, and I was showing him and his wife around. And so I took him on. You know, we were walking around. And it was my last night. It was kind of a balmy evening, which is unusual because Berkeley, you know, because of San Francisco Bay, you know, even in the summer it can get really cold at night. And so it was kind of balmy. We were walking and talking, and we walked down Telegraph Avenue, ran to our own party. And so it's funny because people in those days, California was, I mean, to put it mildly, it was the center of the galaxy. And so whenever people came to other places like Virginia, Mississippi, or anywhere, they just wanted to know, like, please tell me what I should do. How should I be cool? Because if you were from California, especially Berkeley or someplace like that, I mean, definitely anyone that came from anywhere else was your cool disciple. I mean, they had to learn how to be cool. And they really, then they understood that. And they came there to be trained up in, like, being totally with it. And that was kind of like his mood, you know? It's like, just telling me what to do, just, you know, just wanted to know, like, how can I somehow join the California cool?
Yeah.
And so I said, like, oh yeah, this is really good. So I just, oh, okay, so then we all chanted. And, but I had this amazing experience. It really was Krishna, because I'd already seen Prabhupada a few months before that.
You saw Prabhupada in the spring of 69.
I saw Prabhupada, I think it was January, February of 69, yeah. So this was a couple, maybe 3 months later. And so I was chanting with the devotees. And as I chanted, I got this amazing realization. I mean, I'd never read a Krishna conscious book. And I mean, I was away from home in Berkeley in 1969. I mean, I don't know how loose I was about anything. But as I was chanting, I actually realized that somehow Krishna, I didn't know what Krishna was, but I just knew that, Krishna, whatever was meant by it, I just realized that Krishna was present in his name, whoever he was, and actually come into this universe in the form of his name, save everyone. That's just another clear realization that Krishna come into the universe in the form of his name. And I could almost like see the holy name coming into the world from a higher plane. I was just ecstatic. And as I was chanting, I began chanting so ecstatically that, you know, at a certain point I said, okay, I guess we gotta go now. Because, you know, I was just showing my friend around. Dropped in. So I was chanting exactly that when I went to leave the kirtan, the devotees actually all came up and started embracing me. It was amazing. Yeah, they started embracing me, and it was just I was really ecstatic. And it was real. It wasn't like a hippie wild thing. It was like real spiritual ecstasy. In fact, after I saw Prabhupada earlier, I couldn't remember what he said because, you know, I'd never heard philosophy before. But I just, when Prabhupada left the room, I wanted to give up everything and just chant Hare Krishna. I just wanted to chant Hare Krishna day and night. And so I had that experience. And then I went home to L.A. the next day. There's a few stories.
At that time, had you given up? Did you identify with any religion? Had you given up sort of your foundational Jewish?
I wasn't, I would say that from the very beginning of my sort of search, to use the hacking word, I took it for granted. I assumed as an obvious fact that God was present in all these religions. So I never had the concept. You know, fortunately, I have to say, I was never poisoned by this, sort of like this fanatical born-again idea that there's a true religion and false religions. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, Judaism was more like, you know, that's your family. Those are your, those are your people, your tribe. But in terms of spirituality and theology, it just wasn't fanatical like that. And so I didn't have any concept of, like, false religions and true religions. It was just, yeah, it seemed like the most obvious thing in the world to me. God is present in all these different religions. It's just a question of getting the best possible information about God. So to me, Judaism was there's nothing to give up. I mean, God, I'd experienced God through Judaism. And so there's no question of giving it up. I just wanted to move on and get additional information. You know, I had no concept of like, nothing fanatical. I was just trying to get additional information. I would, of course, it goes back even till 68. You know that story, 68. Mm-hmm. I went to Europe.
Yeah.
And everyone, it was just a thing. Like, I followed my brother. Like, he introduced me to certain music. Like he was sort of ahead of the curve. Like, before Bob Dylan was really very well known. He was buying Bob Dylan albums, but it was sort of an underground thing. And then, I mean, things like that, and other musicians, like Jimi Hendrix, like before everyone else knew about it, somehow he knew about it. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I'd play his records. And then he went to Europe in 1967, I think it was. 1967, or I can't remember what summer it was. Anyway, I mean, maybe 66, but I was, you know, he went to Europe and he came back with all these, like, you know, pictures and souvenirs, and it's like, oh my God. So we were just so simple. I mean, it was a huge thing that he'd gone to Europe. He'd actually gone to Europe. And so naturally, you know, I have to go to Europe. So then in 1968, I took a charter flight, a University of California charter flight, left from L.A., and landed in Amsterdam. And, I mean, it was cheap back then. It was very cheap back then. And I bought a Eurail pass. I could travel, you know, free on all the trains in Europe. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've told you those stories. Mm-hmm. But then, if that's where... Because I was already like I was going to join the Peace Corps. I told you that. My brother talked me out of it. I was becoming so frustrated with material life that I wanted to go as farthest point I could find on the map away from like industrialized nations. And
what was frustrating?
I remember when I was. It's like 18, we're not these bodies. You wrote a little poem about it. And I sort of recognized, sort of realized the meaninglessness of material life. And I remember constantly thinking it's just like animal life, it's just selfishness. The selfishness and meaninglessness. I mean, I even used those terms, but just thought it was just like animal life. I remember one time being at the Berkeley campus and just almost having this, like this, epiphany, this realization, it was just sophisticated animal life. And I wanted to know, I think I wanted Krishna. I really wanted Krishna. I wanted to know the purpose of life, the meaning of life, and I was, you know, I didn't want anything superficial, I wanted to know what's it really all about. And so I was really frustrated, so there were some Peace Corps recruiters on campus, so I got an application. I looked at a map, and the most remote place I could find was Micronesia. So I was going to apply for Micronesia. You know, in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. Yeah, the Pacific Ocean is actually Pacific Ocean is twice as wide as the Atlantic Ocean. It's really big, and so my brother, you know, kind of sat me down and said, "Can we talk about this?" So then, okay, so I wasn't going to Micronesia in the Peace Corps. But then I had to do something science. I'll go to Europe for the summer. So then I went down. Actually, I transferred one quarter from UCLA so I could live at home, save money, and actually get a job, which is excruciating. And then,
what was that?
I got a job just in a grocery store because I used to help my father, so I knew how to do that.
Yeah.
I remember Johnny Mathis came in the store. It was in Hollywood. Johnny Mathis came in the store one day. You heard of it. So I went to Europe constantly. I constantly searched. I really went to Europe because I wanted to. It was so amazing going to Europe and traveling everywhere. North Africa, Greek islands. You know all those stories. Riding a motorbike off of cliff on a Greek island. So, anyway, so, and then by the time I landed in Amsterdam, then I went to Copenhagen, Stockholm, then around Norway, back to Copenhagen, Germany, Austria, Italy, Greece, and back to Italy. And then by the time I got back to Italy, getting spent the last month of my trip, then I went to Spain. I took a train from Rome to Madrid, you know, around the Mediterranean, and And then I went down to North Africa, had adventures there. And then by the time I was coming back from the southern coast of Spain, back to Madrid, then I was going to go to Paris, and then from there to London, actually first to France. And I was already realizing that in Europe it was just sort of a more quaint, historical, sophisticated version of the same thing in America, same selfishness. And so, actually, I was a writer. I used to keep it like a little journal. And so I made a conscious decision, which I wrote down in my journal, that actually the only worthy goal in life was to find God. And so when I went back to school, I was just going to dedicate myself to that. That's really what life was about. The purpose of life was to find God. And so, and I actually kept my the commitment. And when I got back to Berkeley, I remember that every day when I woke up in the morning, you know, I'd just get ready to go to school every morning, I would consciously just be trying to understand, who am I? What is consciousness? What is God? I remember just walking these liberties, consciously trying to, just, you know, those questions, who am I? Where have I come from? What is, how can one come to higher consciousness? What is enlightenment? And just thinking constantly about that. And then Prabhupada came.
So that was the semester you first saw the devotees on the...
No, I'd seen them earlier, I think.
Before you went to Europe.
Yeah, I don't, let me see, let me think, let me see. It might have been when I got back. Yeah, it might have been when I got back. Or it might have been the year before, because then they went to San Francisco in 67. There's no temple in Berkeley.
Because you graduated from high school spring of 66.
Yeah, then I went to UCLA the first quarter. Just till December.
Yeah.
And I transferred, so in January, I went to Berkeley in January of
67.
Oh, here's another interesting thing. When I flew up to Berkeley to start school there in January, I actually flew to the Bay. I arrived in the Bay Area the same week that Prabhupada did. Prabhupada arrived in the same area, Bay Area, the same week that I did.
Yeah.
And then I was at Berkeley from January 67 till. I guess around March 68, because then I went down for one quarter to L.A. to earn some money. Mm-hmm. I came back September 69. So around the time, I'm not sure I saw the devotees, but...
Prabhupada came in January of 69.
February, yeah, the winter of 69, I think.
69. And then when did you get initiated? November of...
Maybe December 69, January 70.
Mm-hmm.
Things went so quickly. Yeah, it's amazing. And then, just 2 years and 8 months after I just moved into the temple, I was sannyasi. 2 years and 8 months. And a little more. It was a very powerful time. Of course, a lot of people fell away, but... A little over 2 years, 2.5 years before that, I was out there. And then, literally, just like a little over 2.5 years later, I was a sannyasi. Traveling around the country, chastising everyone. decrying materialism. I got, it's like, how old are you now?
28.
I mean, I was 23. I was like so much younger than you. I was like a 23-year-old kid. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Belinda's age took some else. Yeah, it's in retrospect. I was 23 years old. Yeah, Govinda's age.